Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. When Slobodan Milosevic appeared before the War Crimes Tribunal this morning, he portrayed himself as a victim. Well, Milosevic is many things to many people, but he is certainly consistent. 14 years ago, as a relatively unknown Communist Party leader in Yugoslavia, he traveled to Kosovo Polje, and when local Serbs greeted him with complaints of persecution by the Albanians, Milosevic picked up a microphone, faced the crowd, and called out, "Niko ne sme da vas bija," no one will ever beat you again. It became a rallying cry for Serb nationalists, repeated in Croatia in the early 90s, in the hills around Sarajevo in subsequent years, and once again in Kosovo 2 years ago. "Niko ne sme da vas bija," no one will ever beat you again. This morning in The Hague, the former leader of Yugoslavia stood as a prisoner before the International War Crimes Tribunal and denounced the court as illegal. More of the persecution of Serbs. Regardless of how Milosevic chooses to play his courtroom hand, his incarceration already has far-reaching implications for the way we regard war crimes and for the future of the Balkan nations. Connection listeners, how do you regard the trial of Slobodan Milosevic? Can justice be served in such a charged atmosphere? And is this the beginning of an end to Serbian isolation? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That is 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests today, Laura Silber. She's co-author of the book Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation, and a senior policy advisor at the Open Society Institute. She joins us from the Museum of Television and Radio Studio in New York. And Jean-Jacques Joris is the special political advisor to the chief prosecutor in The Hague. That's where he is this morning. Mr. Joris, I'll begin with you. Mr. Milosevic's appearance was not a very long one this morning.
No, indeed, it was rather short, and he took a political stand of denying jurisdiction of the tribunal, which was very much in the cards. It was, you know, predictable and expected.
I found there was a very revealing tone in it. Let's listen to a bit of that moment. Richard May is the presiding judge.
In these circumstances, if you wish to have time to consider whether you want to have counsel or not, we would be prepared to give it to you. Now, do you want some time to consider now whether you wish to be represented?
I consider this tribunal false tribunal and indictments false indictments. It is illegal being not appointed by UN General Assembly, so I have no need to appoint counsel to illegal organ.
Mr. Joris, one thing that puzzles me about the trial, we keep hearing that it may be months before it begins and years before it's over. Why will it take so long?
Well, it will take some months because Mr. Milosevic has to get acquainted with the all the evidences, all the file of the prosecution has against him, and that will take some time. Whether he maintains his position not to have defense counsel or if he does it himself, but as far as the duration of the trial is concerned, it is really too early to speculate on how long. I would not say, well, probably over 1 year, but not much over that.
Is that partly because the charges against Mr. Milosevic are sort of a moving target? Nobody really knows whether or not he's going to be called to account for events in Croatia, in Bosnia, as well as what happened in Kosovo. Is that part of the confusion?
Well, I wouldn't call it confusion. I would say that...
Confusion, yeah, on my part, perhaps.
Yeah, no, not at all. No, we have two, that's true, we have two ongoing investigations on Bosnia and Croatia. These should conclude relatively soon by in September, at the latest at the beginning of October, and by that time we will know exactly all the charges that will be brought against Milosevic. But in any case, we are trial ready for the alleged crimes committed in Kosovo.
I'd like to bring Laura Silber into the conversation now, Laura, because you've spent so much time on this. I'm wondering what went through your mind when you listened to the voice of Mr. Milosevic in The Hague.
Well, I thought it was vintage Milosevic. It was perfectly in keeping with his character. He looked as if he were presiding over some sort of central committee meeting in 1990. He seemed perfectly comfortable. It was, again, he acted as if he was showing, he was thumbing his nose at the outside world. And he was also, I think, revealing that he thinks this is another chance to grandstand. And I wouldn't be surprised if he thinks somehow he can bring down the Hague Tribunal.
It may well be an opportunity for him to make some of the points that he wants to make, though, might it not?
Well, sure it is. And I think it's important, obviously, that he is, at one point, he will be given a chance to testify. I think, though, that it's important that the Serbs and the people in Yugoslavia see it and understand that it will be a fair trial, that there is a due process. And this is very important, I think, for coming to terms with the fact that Mr. Milosevic is now standing trial in The Hague.
Mr. Djoris, you were there at the time. It sounded, as I listened to recordings of that short appearance, that there were times when Mr. Milosevic's microphone was actually turned off by the court. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. The judge made it very clear, Judge May made it very clear, that, you know, this is the first step in the proceedings. It is mainly a point where we clarified some technical, formal matters, procedure, and it is certainly not at this stage that Mr. Milosevic can engage in an explanation, whether political or not, on what he thinks of the tribunal. This, as Mrs. Silva says, he will be allowed to do at a later stage.
He has marked himself over the years, though, as a brilliant tactician when it comes to getting things done the way he wants to get them done. Is it possible that he will be able to continue to stall the process of the court of the case against him to a point that works to his advantage? Laura, perhaps you could start with that.
I think he might try that, and I think he'll do a sort of short-term maneuvering. But again, he's maybe a brilliant tactician, but a disastrous strategist. So I think whatever he tries, it's going to fall flat.
Explain what you mean by that. Brilliant tactician, but a bad strategist.
Well, I mean, clearly we saw his political career. He tried to take over the whole of former Yugoslavia, the Yugoslavia of six republics and two provinces, and ultimately, drew back, trying then just for a so-called Greater Serbia, and in the end was a prisoner and ruling over only his own house. So I think that we see that Milosevic failed in his goals, not to say all the destruction and the killings that he could be responsible for. I think that he failed, and that's one of the kind of, I think, poignant moments of this, is that when he was taken to The Hague, he didn't even believe where he was going. He refuses, I think, to come to terms, or maybe is unable to come to terms with reality and see the process that is facing him.
Mr. Djoris, I wonder if Mr. Milosevic is looking at this with the idea that you're going to have, that the International War Crimes Tribunal will have a very, very difficult time proving the case against Mr. Milosevic, that it's one thing to blame him for the moral responsibility or the political responsibility, but that you have to get to the issue of criminal responsibility.
No, I think the case on Kosovo is solid. It is really solid. And of course, it will be a challenging trial, but they are we're fully confident. Now, it is true that for Croatia and Bosnia, and that is one of the reasons why these investigations have taken quite some time now, that we want the case to be just as solid as the one we have in Kosovo.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we are discussing the first appearance at the International War Crimes Tribunal of Slobodan Milosevic. And Lewis joins us on the line. Lewis, you're making the connection here. Do you have a question?
Well, I have a statement, but the question would be, the statement is that I find it a bit interesting that the argument is for justice and fairness when $1 billion or more was held over the head of Yugoslavia to turn Milosevic in. Billions of dollars were spent to destroy the country or to put them in a situation where they need the money. The situation in Kosovo clearly is one different from Croatia and different from Bosnia, because I believe that Milosevic, who was elected by his people at the time, believed he was defending the sovereignty of his nation from the Kosovar Albanians, who we now know to be terrorists and you know, murderers themselves and things of that nature. But to say that there's fairness and justice when the trial, you know, the courts are working one way for Milosevic, brought him there under these circumstances, and then they're now saying that this is going to be a fair tribunal, it doesn't seem that way. So,
Lewis, I just wanted to pick up on the point that you're making about whether or not Mr. Milosevic will be able to make the case to the tribunal that he was the sovereign elected leader of his people and protecting his nation. Is that the sort of defense, Mr. Jaris, which will cause some difficulty for the prosecution?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. There is no immunity. Mr. Milosevic, because he's been elected, was elected as president of Yugoslavia and president of Serbia, does not enjoy any immunity, any privilege in front of this tribunal. On the other hand, I can reassure your listener that he will be granted an absolutely fair trial. I mean, it's
how can it be?
Go ahead, Lewis. Are you there?
Yes. How can it be fair that if he's basically brought to this position by threats of money and resources taken away from this country that the U.S. spent millions of dollars on destroying, on a case that was spurious from the beginning? I mean, the Kosovo Albanians who were involved in this takeover of that area, he believed he was fighting against terrorists the same way they do in Spain, the same way Israel feels about the Palestinians at times. He felt that he was defending the sovereignty of his nation. On those bases, you're saying that he did things that were illegal. I don't know of any country at war trying to defend themselves against what they believe is terrorists would be considered in the same position that you're now saying Milosevic has now violated international law for trying to defend the sovereignty of what he considered his nation.
Jean-Jacques, okay. Go ahead.
Yes, two things. First of all, he's not here because he was kidnapped, as you suggest, or the object of a blackmail on behalf of the United States or the international community. He's here because it is the clear obligation of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and also in that case it's the Government of the Republic of Serbia, which acted to arrest and transfer people indicted by this tribunal. This is a clear international obligation. Now, on the other hand, this tribunal does not deal with the big questions as to whether, you know, he defended his country or not defended his country, whether it was a right move, a right strategy, a wrong strategy for Serbia. We're dealing with very, I would say, technical matters, appalling crimes, okay, which is the reality of what was committed during the conflict. Now, the question of who started the conflict or whether they were right or not right is one which is beyond our command and which is will be best dealt with by historians political analysts, whatever, but not by this tribunal. Whether you do the right thing for your country or not, it does not excuse, it does not justify crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, breach of the law and customs of war, etc. And that's what we deal with.
But that's really, I think, what makes this such a fascinating case for everybody to watch, is that you can't separate the legality from the political aspect and all the sort of national tensions that people bring to it. And we will explore that as we continue the conversation here. We're talking about the first court appearance of Slobodan Milosevic before the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. Do you think it's possible for Mr. Milosevic to get a fair trial? What do you think of the process? Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the case against Slobodan Milosevic today. This morning was his first court appearance at the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. I'm joined by Laura Silber. She's co-author of Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation, also by Jean-Jacques Jaris. He's special political advisor to the prosecutor Carla Del Ponte of the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. And we'll be joined very shortly by Alexa Gilas. He's a sociologist and historian in Belgrade. I thought, though, we would begin with part of the exchange that the former president had with the presiding judge, Richard May, earlier today.
The first matter is the indictment. As you may know, you have the right to have the indictment read out now in court before you plead to it. This is a right which you may also waive. Now, do you want to have the indictment read out or not?
That's your problem.
Mr. Alexagilis, what are your thoughts this morning, listening to the tape of Mr. Milosevic's first appearance at The Hague?
Well, Milosevic, for all his great faults, has strong nerves and doesn't panic in difficult situations, and it seems he's ready to fight, and it is going to be a very, very interesting trial. I personally have criticized Milosevic, basically since he came to power to Serbia in 1987, and I have accused him of war crimes when he was in power during wars in Bosnia and Croatia, and I have not changed my mind. Nevertheless, I think that the Hague Tribunal is an illegal institution which uses judicial procedures which would be completely unacceptable in any civilized country, and it is also an instrument for political manipulation by NATO countries and mostly by the United States. Here we have a guilty man on trial by a guilty court.
Can you be specific and perhaps put the disagreement you have about the standing of the court to Mr. Jaris? Because I'd like to hear the two sides of that.
I mean, there are so many problems there, right?
Pick one, because we'll have callers on the line.
Yes, I will not bore your... first of all, the tribunal doesn't have a jury. Then people are kept in custody for unlimited time. Then the tribunal uses anonymous witnesses, which makes it practically impossible for the defense to defend the accused, and the explanation of the court is that that's how they want to protect witnesses. But in America, you know, people are witnesses against mafia, organized crime, and there is a witness protection program. Why didn't they organize that in The Hague? Worst of all, Mr. Jean-Jacques Joris just recently said how they are now investigating crimes in Bosnia, right? Because the case is complicated. The case in Bosnia is not complicated at all. Everyone knew that both Serbia and Croatia were sending weapons and paramilitary formations in Bosnia, which were committing crimes in 1992. So that was 9 years ago. Everyone knew that. All papers wrote about it. I knew about it. Every child knew about it. And both Mr. Milosevic, president of Serbia, and Mr. Franjo Tuđman, president of Croatia, were guilty of crimes in Bosnia. Nevertheless, the United States needed the two leaders for peace in Bosnia, and therefore prevented CIA and other intelligence agencies for giving the evidence to the Hague Tribunal.
Mr. Gilles, let's let Jean-Jacques Jaris have a moment here to answer
Mr. Jean-Jacques Jaris, right, is not an independent prosecutor. He is actually a tool of the intelligence agencies used to blackmail politicians.
Let's hear from him.
Well, that's something new for my resume. I was not aware of that. Now, about the investigations in Bosnia, I'm not saying that we're just investigating now. We've been investigating for quite a long time. But the kind of conviction that the man on the street or Mr. Gilles might have is not sufficient, because precisely this is a serious court and one in which the rights of the accused are well protected. It's not sufficient to make the case in court. So what we need is very solid evidence, and that evidence is available. To have that, to get hand on that evidence, you need the full cooperation of all states involved. And it's only very recently that we've had access to Yugoslavia. Under Slobodan Milosevic, there was no access for our investigators whatsoever. Even in the framework of investigations conducted on crimes committed against Serbs, because Milosevic did not want to allow the tribunal to show that it was proceeding against all sides. So it's only recently that we have access to key evidence in Yugoslavia that will help us make our case and establish the kind of evidence we need for the trial.
Laura Silber, I'd like to hear your point of view on this issue.
Well, I have to say, frankly, I disagree with Alexa on several points. And I think one of the key things that he's ignoring, it's not a point of whether Mr. Franjo Tudjman and Mr. Slobodan Milosevic were trying to divide up Bosnia. I certainly agree with him on that. But that shouldn't be confused with the issue of war crimes and crimes committed by Serbian forces or Croatian forces. And Alexa, as you well know, there are 11 Croats, Bosnian Croats, who have been indicted by The Hague. So to accuse The Hague of being something other than impartial in the trial process, I think is really looking at it blindly and maybe falling prey to some of the propaganda that was unleashed by Milosevic during his rule.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Andre is on the line. Hi, Andre.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A brief comment. The euphoria in The Hague may be premature. With Milosevic's extradition, the game is not over by far, and in fact, it has not even yet begun the public relations stage of the Milosevic hunt. It's what's over. Now, bridging the gap between the summary accusations of the latter years and the facts on the ground will be the order of the day, and the Hague Tribunal may face an uphill race here. Milosevic, in my judgment, may well have the capacity to turn the table on his accusers, because the limelight will be intense and so will be the public scrutiny in the quest for the culprits. Now, NATO's complicity in Srebrenica, in Sarajevo market bombings, Račak, and the KLA's arming and training by NATO will be on the table. Things will be called by their names, and big names will be named.
Just before we go on, you talked about NATO's complicity in the market bombing in Sarajevo.
Absolutely. It was masterminded and carried out by the Bosnian secret services.
Who says?
Oh, God, it's all over the place. Do you read papers, European papers? It's on the record.
Okay, Laura Silber, this is the sort of thing that you research for your book. Is it as cut and dried as that? Andre, stay with us, because
sure.
I'm not cutting you off.
I don't believe it's as cut and dried as that by any means. Certainly, I've heard a lot of theories and possibilities about the marketplace bombing, and I wouldn't even exclude the possibility that it wasn't exactly as it seems. And I think that's not the point, though. The point is not about one grenade or one massacre. The point is there were several. So maybe, and I'm not excluding it, I think that there are other indications that may indicate something about it wasn't exactly as it seems at the time. On the other hand, I've never seen any convincing proof that, yes, this was actually masterminded by the Bosnian Secret Service. And I think, again, that Andre may have a point. This obviously, it's not cut and dried. We're going to see a lot of things. It's going to be a really interesting trial. Mr. Milosevic, I think, will try to cast a net as wide as he can in terms of dragging other people down with him, not only from Serbia, but obviously Western European and even American politicians. We're going to see a lot of things there. But I don't think that he can accuse NATO of complicity in Srebrenica. You can accuse perhaps the UN or something of complicity in their failure to act to stop the slaughter or to stop and rescue the Bosnian Muslims in Srebrenica. But they certainly didn't carry out the crime of slaughtering up to 8,000 people in Srebrenica.
Surely, Andre, this is the point that is up to the tribunal to adjudicate on, that they will do their best to try and get the facts out on this. Do you not have the confidence in the tribunal being able to do that in an impartial way?
Well, all I can say is the best of the luck to the tribunal, because with the U.S. and NATO closets bursting with skeletons, Milosevic's trial may well turn out to be the indictment of those who for years sought his head. And by destroying Milosevic, the Hague Tribunal may be paving the road to its own self-destruction as well. As they say, be careful what you wish for.
Thank you very much,
sure.
Andre. Matthew is joining The Connection from Buffalo, New York. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine.
I had a question. It's more of a general question, I guess, but it has to do with the with immunity that leaders are granted in nations around the world from time to time, like when you look at Western countries that take part in actions overseas who are not held accountable for the actions of their troops or for the overall situation. And I understand that the Hague Tribunal deals with Yugoslav issues. It's not. You know, they're not going to go charging everybody around the world.
Well, no, they're engaged with Rwandan issues and others as well. I mean, this is not something which is specific to the Balkans.
Okay. Well, in that case, when will an international tribunal charge, say, George Bush and Bill Clinton, as well as many other U.S. and foreign politicians, for their role in what you see now in Iraq, where there's hundreds of thousands of people whose deaths can be connected to the embargo against the nation?
Alexei Gilas in Belgrade, this sounds like one of the frustrations underpinning the sentiment that you've been describing in Belgrade.
Well, you know, this is many Serbs are asking questions. You know, how come NATO leaders can under no circumstances be brought to trial? And it is not just the question of NATO leaders. If you take the bombing of Serbia in the spring of 99, whether you think it was necessary or not, the truth is many war crimes were committed during the bombing. I mean, first of all, Serbian forces did commit crimes against Albanians. I'm not doubting that, and Milosevic is guilty. But, for example, NATO bombed bridges in Novi Sad, 600 kilometers away from Kosovo. No justification. Destroyed our petrochemical industry and polluted large areas of Serbia. They bombed with cluster bombs, which are forbidden, civilian city of Niš. They bombed bridges, trains, buses with civilians. They bombed a column of Albanian refugees returning to Kosovo, killing 70 people. They used bullets from depleted uranium. Not only that big shots like Clinton or Albright or President Chirac and so on will never be brought to justice, but not even a general or an Air Force captain will be indicted or even questioned for the crimes committed. So this looks to many people in Serbia as if, you know, those who are strong and powerful, they are above the law. And then those who are weak, get this so-called Hague justice.
Jean-Jacques Jéris, it seems to me to be a complaint that is being repeated often these days, that as long as the International War Crimes Tribunal appears to be targeting just one side, its own credibility is called into question.
Well, it's certainly not targeting just one side. As you know, we've had accused on all sides of the conflicts that rage in the former Yugoslavia.
But are you investigating NATO's bombing of Serbia in 1999 as well?
The NATO bombings came under very close scrutiny, and we published a review that concluded that no investigation should be opened because the elements of conviction were simply not available. And I would invite Mr. Gilas to read that review. Once you get into the technicalities of the law of armed conflicts, you realize that lots of notions that are current in the public, and I'm not saying that the current standard of humanitarian law, that is the law of armed conflict, is satisfactory. What I'm saying is the law is what it is. And when you speak of cluster bombs, I mean, this is an absolutely tragic case, regrettable, where one cluster bomb went astray on the marketplace in Niš. Cluster bombs per se are not prohibited, as well as is the case for ammunition containing depleted uranium. It is not prohibited by the international law of armed conflicts as it stands today.
You're saying it's not criminal, even though it may not be moral or politically acceptable.
I'm saying it is certainly, and judging from, you know, opinion not only in Serbia but in many countries of the world, it seems that many kinds of armaments and ammunitions are considered not politically acceptable, but legally, they still are accepted.
You're listening
so
to the
as long as it does not breach the law, you cannot speak of a crime.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Daniel, you're on the line.
Hi there, how are you?
Fine.
I don't want to be considered to be a Milosevic apologist, and certainly not, but one thing that troubles me is the fact that Milosevic is being brought to trial, and there's so many other more prominent criminals, well, perhaps not more prominent, but more dastardly criminals in this incident, who are not even being, at this point, arrested. I mean, I speak specifically of Radovan Karadzic, and I wonder what kind of legitimacy the trial of Milosevic will have while these others remain within, you know, known areas, but yet aren't arrested, aren't brought to trial themselves.
Laura Silber, can I ask you to answer that?
I agree. I think that all indicted war criminals have to be brought to justice. And so whether it's Radovan Karadzic or Ratko Mladic, I think, though, that Milosevic is a very important, obviously establishes a very important precedent. He was one of the main players in the conflicts in former Yugoslavia. So I don't think that just because they have Milosevic in the dock that the Hague Tribunal and other forces won't act to against Karadzic or Mladic. I think it may make it easier. I also think it's scandalous that NATO did not act over the past, since the indictments, didn't act to arrest these two people, where you're right, we do know where they are, or some people know where they are, and that they haven't acted to arrest them.
At the end of this particular part of the program, Jean-Jacques Jarrys has to move on. So just a final point to you, Mr. Jarrys. Does the tribunal, is the tribunal working hard to try and bring Karadzic and Mladic in, and do you suffer for the days that they are not there?
Yes, we do. We do. Prosecutor has been adamant that it is not acceptable, and it is a real, you know, damageable for the credibility of the international community and of the international forces in Bosnia, that these two key indictees have been, you know, at large for 6 years. Now, this is a question you have to put to S4 and to the countries that have troops in Bosnia, not to us. Just one last thing. Sure, it is important that we have Milosevic. To that person who raised the question of the legitimacy of a trial of Milosevic while others indictees remain at large, I can just reverse the question, you know, because whenever we arrest or have someone from the other side, a Bosnian Croat, arrested, the question is, why should a trial go on while Milosevic and all other culprits are still at large? So at least we have one now, and I believe it sets a signal. And it will, I hope, reverse the trend so that we can get all our indictees as soon as possible into Hague.
Mr. Jarrys, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We are discussing on The Connection this hour the indictment and the arraignment today of the former leader of Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and this hour we are discussing the arraignment of Slobodan Milosevic before the International War Crimes Tribunal. Politics, justice, or interference? My guests are Laura Silber. She's senior policy advisor at the Open Society Institute and co-author of Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation, and Alexa Gilas, who is a sociologist and a historian, who's joining us from Belgrade. Now, Alexa, I suspect I may be a little rough on you earlier, because the point that you're making is that you've been an outspoken critic of Milosevic all along and would have liked to have seen him brought to book in Belgrade, but that didn't happen. Why not?
Well, it could have happened, you see. First of all, Milosevic, we now have a democracy of a sort in Serbia, or at least we are developing in that direction. In any case, our judiciary is not controlled by Milosevic and his people. And Milosevic was arrested. He was in jail, right?
But those were on much smaller charges than war crimes. Let's be clear.
Well, it was first of all, the charges didn't look very convincing to me, while those on war crimes do look convincing. But nevertheless, the very fact that the authorities had enough power to arrest him and charge him and keep him in custody for almost 2 months, and the fact that there are many excellent judges in Serbia, and they're rather good if you don't put them under political pressure, points clearly to me that we could have had trial in Belgrade. As the situation is now, our government, if we call things by their name, sold Milosevic for money. We were blackmailed by the West, in particular by the United States, that we will not get aid, and that our debt repaying, because we have a huge debt repaying regime, will be made particularly harsh. So therefore the government decided, well, you know, we need money and we don't need Milosevic. But if you are asking me, this is not a way for a nation to reach moral catharsis. On the contrary, you know, I think to many people Serbs will appear worse than they were before. And the proper way to convince Serbian people, right, is to put him on trial in Belgrade, where he would have our judges and judge him and our prosecutor, and that would really convince Serbian people that there were very, very serious crimes committed by Milošević in Kosovo. And of course also in Bosnia, it is really silly when Mr. Jaurès says that they have had enough time for a solid case for Kosovo, which was 2 years ago, but they didn't have time for a solid case against Milošević 9 months after Bosnia and with all the evidence Bosnian government presented him. So I think this trial may actually turn out to be a triumph for Milošević, because he is not a coward, he is rather clever. Right? People will think the tribunal is unfair, and instead of a moral catharsis, you know, people will say, here we are again, victims of Western conspiracies, and there will again be this paranoid political culture which has done us so much harm.
We were talking about that a little earlier in the program. Laura Silber, I'd like to bring you in on this point, because what Alex is saying is that for the way that this is being seen within Yugoslavia, within Serbia and Belgrade, the people had that opportunity to demonstrate their integrity taken away from them. Do you think that the perspective will be shared by people looking from outside at Serbia, that they were robbed of the opportunity to demonstrate that they can handle their own?
No, I think outside people probably won't look at it that way. But I do think that Alexa has put his finger on something really important, and that is, to me, the greatest drawback of having the trial in The Hague is that now Serbs do not actually have ownership of the process. And because of the whole perception in Serbia that the Hague Tribunal was actually founded to get the Serbs and to punish the Serbs, that it's very anti-Serbian from its very conception, I think that that's going to be the greatest obstacle for The Hague to overcome. And this won't be able to be accomplished overnight. I think that it's going to be a large amount of responsibility resting with the media in Serbia, as well as obviously with the outreach program in The Hague, in the sense of educating the people of Serbia about the trial.
But it may get a lot dirtier in the other direction, Laura, because if members of the Yugoslav army choose to turn on Milosevic and give evidence against him, you'll be seeing these senior military people coming to The Hague and in effect exacerbating the splits that already exist within Belgrade.
Well, I think that since I was in Belgrade last week, and to me, the recent revelations about bodies from Kosovo being buried in the outskirts of Belgrade have really shocked people. It brought home the fact that many people really, I think, didn't know or didn't want to know that there were terrible crimes committed, and some of these crimes were committed by Serbian forces in the name of Serbs. And I think people don't want the responsibility of this. They don't want to feel that they are guilty, and that it will help people and the catharsis that Alexa referred to, in the sense of they are not to be blamed. Obviously, the people who carried out these crimes, the people who ordered these crimes, are to be blamed. So I think that this is what, when the people in Serbia hear an army general or whether it's another politician testify and reveal actually what happened, I think this will be an incredibly important step in the process of Serbs and also other nations of the region. Obviously, Serbs are not the only ones who bear responsibility for the conflicts in former Yugoslavia, just in coming to terms with what has happened and in moving forward from this point.
Let's let some of our callers in on the conversation. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection, and Elliot is on the line.
I just wanted to raise a concern. Can you hear me?
Yes, Elliot, go ahead.
A concern that this whole notion of war crimes is in fact a way of legitimizing war itself, that war is the crime. And that to say that one act in war is not a crime and the other is, that Robert McNamara walks the streets and Henry Kissinger walks the streets, but Milosevic is a criminal. I think it's nonsense. I think that war itself is the crime, that these type of trials and the whole concept of war crimes only serves to legitimize the whole concept and practice of war.
But we're sort of stuck with the reality of conflict, though, aren't we, Elliot? I mean, what are we to do if we are not to, at least make some attempt to try and call people to answer for what they may have done.
But where do you draw the line?
Exactly. I don't have the answer to that.
If you accept war as a legitimate political activity and a legitimate function of government, then to say that anything is criminal, I mean, if you look at World War I, put millions of troops on each side in trenches and let them kill each other for 4 years. I mean, it's nonsense to think that one type of war crime is somehow worse than another crime or that part of it's legitimate.
Yeah, there's
nothing the United States did in Vietnam wouldn't fit into the category of war crimes. You could go back, you know, the bombing of Dresden. You can go anywhere. I mean, to say that one side is right politically or wrong, that's another question.
No, you're absolutely right, and I appreciate you bringing that to the table. I do want to move on, Elliot, so thank you for your call. Suzanne is joining us on the line. Hi, Suzanne.
Oh, good morning. I think it's important to bring up the matter that the UN has not approved this trial, and the UN has earlier not approved other things that we have done, like bombings and the free fly zone that we now sort of accept of Iraq. I think we weaken the UN greatly by not bringing it in as the arbiter of this.
Would that make a difference to the way that this is being seen in Belgrade, Alexei Gilas?
Would what make it difference?
If the UN was the sponsoring agency of the International War Crimes...
But it is. It is the sponsoring agency.
It would definitely increase the authority of the court, right? Because, you know, people see Security Council as dominated by the United States. I also have to say one thing. The Hague Tribunal, which, by the way, I initially supported very much, but then was disenchanted in the process, was founded in 1993. But now Russia, which of course is in the Security Council and voted for the tribunal, wants the tribunal closed. And Sergei Lavrov, a Russian ambassador to the United Nations, demanded sometime in February this year that the tribunal should be closed.
Can I just interrupt for a minute? Laura, you're making the point that in fact, and I believe you're correct, that the UN is the sponsoring agency of the International War Crimes Tribunal. Is that right?
That's right. Obviously, the International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia, that is an organ of the United Nations. And as Alexa pointed out, it was founded by the Security Council in 1993. The lesson of working with the Security Council, which I don't see as dominated by the United States, considering that there are five permanent members of the Security Council, of which the United States is one, as well as Russia and China, they all five permanent members back this. Therefore, it is in fact, an organ of the United Nations. So I don't quite understand why the caller is saying that it wasn't authorized. Now, the no-fly zones over Iraq is a different story, but I think that...
No, you're quite right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but thanks for answering that. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and Eve is joining The Connection. Hi, Eve.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add, a thought to the previous discussion that was going on about, how the people in Serbia are taking this process and how they kind of need to buy into it. And my thought is that this is, possibly an important opportunity for us to take a look at the evolution of a kind of concept of restorative justice and reconciliation that, people availed themselves of in South Africa. And I know that process wasn't perfect, but, I think a lot of people from the outside also, I disagree with the person's comment that said, people from the outside aren't going to look at it this way. I think it's really important for us to take a look at this process, how to prevent something like this from happening in the future. People really
can you be a little more specific, Eve? Can you be more specific about what you're talking about? Are you talking about setting up something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is run by Balkan authorities? What are you talking about?
Well, what I'm talking about is I think, we're in The Hague now, and, it's going to be difficult to climb out of that. But take a look at how this process can evolve. People on both sides need to understand that they don't necessarily have it all right as to how to do this right
now. Let's let our guests in on this. Laura Silber.
there is underway now the formation in Belgrade under the auspices of President Vojislav Koštunica, a Truth and Reconciliation or a Truth and Responsibility Commission, however you want to look at it, beginning now. It hasn't actually started work. There is nothing that says that there can't be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission working at the same time as the Tribunal in The Hague. The Hague is what is actually dealing with the criminal acts of really the big fish. That was what it was founded, was actually to punish the main culprits.
The leaders, the decision makers.
The leaders, exactly. And I think that I agree with the caller, actually. I think that whole other forms of action needs to take place, and I think it is happening. I think it's amazing when we look at Serbia since October, Yugoslavia since October, has come an incredibly long way and made great advances, I think, in building democracy and, in fact, taken steps and is part now of the community of nations. Its isolation has ended, began to end in October, and certainly now has come to an end.
Laura, last quick point to Alexa. Is there time now, even with the tribunal underway, for Serbia to reestablish that credibility, Alexa? And I ask you to be brief.
Yes, well, you know, there are very many positive things in Serbia. More and more people are aware that crimes were committed. The extreme Serbian nationalism is under attack in Serbia. Indeed, Laura's excellent film was shown and many people liked it, and so on. And also, for example, bodies from Kosovo which were discovered shocked many people. The only thing that makes Serbs cynical, right, is the sense that there are biased double standards. And people ask questions. Okay, obviously many of our leaders and military commanders were guilty. But why wasn't President Tudjman, who expelled 400,000 Serbs, or almost 500,000, from Croatia, indicted? He died peacefully in his bed in December 1999. Why has not a single Albanian leader been put on trial? And after NATO forces moved in, over 1,000 Serbs were killed in Kosovo.
These are just a few of many questions that we'll be wrestling with over the next few months. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Alexa, but we have to go on. Thank you both for joining me. Laura Silber, Senior Policy Advisor at the Open Society Institute, co-author of Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. Alexa Gilas is a sociologist and a historian. He talked with us from Belgrade. Earlier, we spoke with Jean-Jacques Jarisse, Special Political Advisor to the Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte of the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague. Connection listeners, you can continue the Milosevic conversation on our website. That's at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll be right back.